course, structure and certification of SIS Enterprise. Last interrupting, I'm sorry to say, Chris Phillips, lectures on cross products. He will then come back after these two lectures. So it'll be this time, and then in 2 weeks, I mean next week, we have the workshop. And I will be talking about a somewhat different topic, namely something that has been on my interest for some time, namely non-simple, purely infinite SIS algebras. And today I will mostly talk about a paper, the first paper written by Eberhard Kirsberg and myself, published in 2000, American Journal of Math, and a little bit also results from other papers, and next time I will somehow try to wrap up some new developments and open questions and things like that. I may also give you next time a list of relevant publications. This is my plan to do that. I should also say that the level of this, I mean, I will try to make a point of addressing PhD students and newly graduated postdocs, so people who are expert in the field may find these lectures kind of boring. The rest of you may also find them boring, I hope not, but it is addressed mainly at people who don't have research experience in this particular field. So when one talks about non-simple purely infinite SIS algebras, it is because in the simple case there has been a lot of success, and I will begin by describing that. Let me get straight that it is non-simple purely infinite, and purely infinite is usually abbreviated for PI SIS algebras. That I will be talking about, and it originates in the simple case that I'm sure that many of you have heard about, but let me just remind you of some relevant definitions and also of some major results. So the first thing in the simple case is a definition or a theorem that goes through the Joachim Kunz and others, saying that if A is a simple SIS algebra, one that has no non-trivial closed two-sided ideals, and A is not the complex numbers, then the following are equivalent. So we have first a very algebraic condition, saying that whenever we have two positive elements, by A with a plus on it, I mean the positive elements are than zero, there exists an element x in A such that B is x star AX. Actually, this is the same thing as if one relaxes it a little bit. But you can take a sequence inside of A such that xn star axn converges to B. So this is just an approximate version of the previous one. And thirdly, you can say that whenever you have a non-zero hereditary sub-SIS algebra of A, then B contains an infinite projection. And I understand that Andrew Thompson has told you about projections and infinite projections, finite infinite projections. So actually this particular definition was the one that Joachim Kunz himself used as the definition of being purely infinite. And let me mention fourthly a condition saying that the real rank of A is zero. I hope that has also been addressed, that particular property. in the course, and all projections in A are infinite or even properly infinite. And then I can put the last condition A is truly infinite. But that will just be a definition. So these four conditions are equivalent, and if they hold, we say that A is truly infinite. And let me remind you, PU is a projection, and PU is said to be properly infinite if it is the case that if you double P, then it is equivalent to a subprojection P naught of P itself. So the twice of P can be put underneath P itself. Let me say P is properly infinite. And it turns out that for simple series algebras, being properly infinite and being infinite turns out to be the same. I will address that also later. So examples of purely infinite series algebras are the most famous ones are the Kunth algebras. And if q less than n less than infinity, then we have, then we can associate a series algebra On. Well, let me say strictly less than infinity for now. That should be the series algebra generated by n elements is 1 up to Sn, which are isometries. And saying that they are isometries means that Sj star Sj is equal to 1. 1 is the unit of the algebra. And the range projections are these things here. They are pairwise orthogonal and add up to the unit. So these are the generators and these are the relations. And that is a Kunth algebra On, and Kunth proved back in the late 70s that these algebras are simple. It's not clear that they are simple. We talk about the universal algebra generating these relations. He proved they are simple and also purely infinite, satisfying these conditions. For n equal to infinity, that is an important algebra also, very much so. This is simply generated by a whole sequence of projections of isometries. I mean, the isometries, it's a whole sequence of them, and now this condition does make sense. You cannot add infinitely many projections in the series algebra. So all we say is that if I is different from j, then Si star is orthogonal to Sj. Sj star. Hence it is generated by a sequence of isometries with orthogonal range projections. And then some some interesting facts about these ones. I mean, two very important Kunth algebras is O infinity and O2, that play a very special role for the topic. And if you look at the K-theory of O infinity, then that is the same as the K-theory of the complex numbers. So this is set respectively 0, if star is 0 and if star is 1. And the K-theory of O2 is trivial, is the same thing as the K-theory of the neural series algebra. It so happens. And there are some what really got this subject going were theorems proved. Well, I mean, there were, let me just write here. They were announced by Kirsberg in in a conference in 94 and subsequently published things put together in a paper with Chris and Kirsberg. And the first result says that if A is purely infinite, simple, separable, and nuclear, then A is isomorphic to A tensor O infinity. Note one thing here, that O infinity has the same K-theory as the complex numbers. Tensoring by the complex numbers does nothing to a Cs algebra. So, from a K-theoretical point of view, these have the same K-theory. This algebra and this one has the same K-theory. And if you then look to the Elliott conjecture, that would say that two Cs algebras who have the same K-theory should be isomorphic. Well, there could be more in the Elliott invariant than just K-theory. I mean, there could be maybe traces coming in, or possibly ideals and such things. And but now we're working with simple case, there are no ideals to worry about. And in the purely infinite case, as we shall also see, there are no traces to worry about either. So the Elliott invariant in the purely infinite case is simply just K-theory. There's nothing else as it stands. So hence, from the Elliott conjecture point of view, these algebras would be isomorphic. And indeed, this theorem says that A is isomorphic to A tensor O infinity if A is purely infinite, separable, and nuclear. So this is a big step towards proving the Elliott conjecture. And another result saying that if A is A is isomorphic to A tensor O2. Sorry, O2 is isomorphic to A tensor O2. Here we should think about O2 as being zero. So tensoring with zero, that is almost like multiplying by zero, then you get zero. So, and again, from a K-theoretical point of view, these have the same K-theory. And so again, the Elliott conjecture would say that it should be isomorphic, provided that there's no reason why it shouldn't be isomorphic, such as traces again and other things. And well, none of these have traces. This holds if and only if A is simple, separable, nuclear, and unital. In that first case, it is not an if and only if condition. If this condition is satisfied, then A is isomorphic to A tensor O infinity, but here we have an if and only if statement. And these results led both Chris Philipp and Eberhard, over the course of actually just half a year, to prove the celebrated classification theorem. They each gave their own proof, and I think to this day there's only Chris's proof that has been published. Eberhard's proof still remains as a preprint from that time. And then that says the following: suppose that A and B are purely infinite, simple, separable, and nuclear. Then we have two different statements. One is that they are strictly isomorphic if and only if they are KK equivalent. And this may not be somehow the best statement here, but let me just comment a little bit on it. When I say strictly isomorphic, it is just because if you don't think about the compact, you have to worry about does it have a unit or does it not have a unit. If it has a unit, then you have one situation. If it doesn't have a unit, then actually it is stable. And if it has a unit, then you have somehow to keep track of what is the class of the unit in the K0 group. So hence, somehow, this statement, if you don't think about the compact, it becomes a little bit more complicated, but you can formulate a very precise statement also in the case where you don't stabilize. But let me just leave it like this to make it very simple. And the other one says, suppose now we take the unital case, suppose that both A and B are unital, and that they are in the so-called UCT class. And the UCT class is, it can be defined in two different ways. One is the correct definition. A C-algebra belongs to the UCT class if we mean it is KK equivalent to an abelian C-algebra. Well, so far I didn't even mention what it means for two C-algebras to be KK equivalent. At this point I will not really do it. I mean, you have to go into look at KK theory and we can say that what this really means is that when they exist x in KKA comma B and y in KKB comma A, such that in applying the cash power product we get this. In other words, that this that we have invertible elements of KKA comma B. That is basically what it means. Deciding whether two C-algebras are KK equivalent without knowing anything about the UCT is difficult. So one can say that this particular statement here can be hard to apply. And so hence, if you use that definition of the UCT class as being KK equivalent to an abelian C-algebra, then it will not be easy to tell for a given C-algebra if it belongs to the UCT class. It is also true that Vordenberg and Schuckert, who were the first to consider the UCT class, they proved that the UCT class is a bootstrap category. So, for example, it contains all abelian C-algebras, which is closed under inductive limit, under stabilizing morphism, and under cross-product by V, and other things. And using these mechanisms, you can easily prove that many C-algebras, for example, the Kunz-algebras and other ones, are in the UCT class. So this is what the theory looks like. But suppose we have two units of C-algebras in the UCT class, then it follows that they are isomorphic, if and only if they have isomorphic Elliott invariants. And the Elliott invariants in this case will be, K0 and K1 just as abelian groups, and then you remember the position of the unit, which is an element here, if this one is isomorphic to the same for B. So these are extremely strong theorems, and they have been used very much, and so they go back to, I should have said that, they go back to 94. They are 13 years old by now, and they are still very much used and celebrated. And let me, before closing up on this particular topic, also mention a proposition saying that whenever you have a triple, such that G0 and G1 are countable abelian groups, and a little G0 is a specific element in capital G0, then they exist a purely infinite simple separable nuclear and unital C star algebra A in the UCT class such that its Elliott invariant is a given one. So we have a complete description of the range of the invariant also in this particular case. So this is just a brief summary of the theory for simple, purely infinite C-star algebras that was concluded in this form 40 years ago. It's not that the topic is completely dormant now. One very interesting line of topic is, for example, if you have a finite group acting on the invariant, to what extent does it live to a finite group of automorphisms in the algebra itself? Tsumi has some interesting results on that line. But then let me not dwell too much more on the simple case, but saying that what is the topic of looking at non-simple, purely infinite C-star algebras is to take, inspired by results like these, can you extend some of them to the non-simple case? Can this theory be, how far does it, can we take it into the non-simple case? So what happens in the non-simple case? And one problem will be, if we look to the definition, what should even be the definition? I mean, we have four different definitions here of being purely infinite, and which one should we choose in the non-simple case? And then the answer is none of them, actually, as it turns out. If we look at the first two ones, it is not hard to see that one implies simplicity. So that would not be a good definition. And the problem about 3 and 4 is that they imply existence of projections. Now, I shall convince you that we don't necessarily want to have projections in the non-simple case. So in the simple case, we have projections, and this is basically because of a result due to Joachim Kunz and Blackadar, that if you have a simple C-star algebra, which is infinite in the sense that it has no trace, or quasi-trace, then it automatically has a projection. So somehow simple C-star algebras which are infinite have projections given for free, which is kind of surprising, but this is not true in the non-simple case. So we cannot use any of the definitions. But before going into that, let me mention some of the results at Kirchberg proved not long after these results were obtained in the simple case. These somehow will be an inspiration for what's going to happen. The first one says, suppose that A is, let me get it right, separable and nuclear and nothing more, A and B. Then, if we tensor A by infinity and stabilize, then it is isomorphic to, again, tensoring by infinity and stabilizing. Recall that tensoring by infinity doesn't alter, it does not change the K-theory. As a purely infinite algebra, as one sees in the simple case, and provided that you have all sorts of other nice things happening, such as being separable and nuclear, then tensoring by infinity doesn't even do anything, it doesn't change it at all. But in general, of course, it is. Tensoring by infinity will make a huge change to the C-star algebra, but not to its K-theory. This is the case if and only if... I have to say something more. Let me do that. If they are K-K equivalent in an ideal-related way, assuming... So I have to say assuming... that the primitive ideal space of A is homeomorphic to the primitive ideal space of B, and this denoted by H. So we're not talking about a simple case. So one thing we should at least have is that the ideal lattices of A and of B are the same. And now instead of talking about an ideal lattice, I talk about the primitive ideal space, and this is that topological space. Which is T0, it separate points, but it's not Hausdorff, and Singleton's not even assumed to be close. It, as a topological space goes, it's kind of a weird one. Let me say that the primitive ideal space has the same information as the ideal lattice of A. So this is the lattice of ideals. And this is, and the primitive ideal space is by definition the set of kernels of irreducible representations. So each element in the primitive ideal space is an ideal, and it's those particular ideals that arise as kernels of irreducible representations. This is just as a set, and then you equip it with the so-called Jacobson topology of the Hull-Kernel topology, the Jacobson topology, which is like this weird topology, and then you have the structure here. But you can somehow flip back and forth between the two. If you know this one, then you know this one. And maybe the ideal lattice can be more easily defined. But it turns out it is, for many practical purposes, easy to work with a primitive ideal space. So that's the statement by Kirchberg. He says that two C-star algebras become, if they're simple and nuclear, they become isomorphic if you tend to them by infinity, provided they are KK equivalent in an ideal related way. And deciding this thing here is very difficult. So very hard to decide. And there are definitely people working on this, and some progress has been made, in particular in the case where the ideal lattice is finite. Then there are some interesting examples. I mean, theorems have emerged, and I did myself, I mean, the case where there's just one non-trivial ideal, I also myself introduced a certain notion of deciding when this happens. So this theorem, as it stands now, is somehow just left with part one of the Kirchberg's Philip theorem, namely this one here, where you have this statement, which is sort of nice enough, but still this is hard to decide, but then you have the UGT class going for you. And if the algebra is going to the UGT class, then you have this much stronger statement, where you have a classification by an invariant. And what this result still needs, at least in the full generality, is somehow a UGT for KK sub X. I will leave it at this, but say that it is not a completely useless theorem. Not only is there some progress in deciding when algebras are KKX equivalent, but there's also the following very impressive corollary. Saying that again, under the same assumptions, A and B are separable and nuclear, then it holds that if you tend to not by O infinity but by O2, which kills all K theory, then these algebras are isomorphic and are all K theory is gone. So the only thing that is left are the ideal lattices, so that is if and only if the primitive ideal space of A is isomorphic or homomorphic to the primitive ideal space of B, which is the same as saying that the ideal lattice of A is isomorphic to the ideal lattice of B. So this is one important step into the non-simple case. And so one question that emerges is that when do we have A is isomorphic to A to the infinity? So in other words, the classification theorem by Kirchberg, which kind of algebras does it really classify? Well, I mean, one can argue that it classifies algebras in this form here. I would like to make a small note, namely that O infinity tends to O infinity is Eisenhower to infinity. Hence, if A is also tangible, and depend to that by infinity, then that, as we call it, absorbs infinity. So if we look at algebras that satisfy this property here, then we just take any theta algebra and tend to that by infinity, and then we have one that does it. And and if we look at a simple case, then we know that a theta algebra absorbs infinity if it is purely infinite, simple, okay, and separable and nuclear. So somehow what we like is a definition of being purely infinite here, so that we get this statement. I mean, that would somehow be the optimal situation. And let me now get to our definition of simplicity. Maybe first I should say just one word about Kunz-Comparison theory. So I will now move towards how to define being purely infinite in the non-simple case, but let me just make the following definition. Suppose we have two positive elements A and B, then we say that A is less than A equal to B, and it is clearly less than if and only if there exists a sequence Xn inside of A, such that Xn star B Xn converges to A. And I think that Andrew Thomas probably have mentioned this is my case. And if one looks at this, basically what is relevant is what you might say the range projection of A and B respectively, or the hereditary subalgebra that they generate. This is basically what is being measured. One may know, for example, that 2A is less than or equal to A, and that A to the power alpha is less than or equal to A for all alpha greater than 0. Because the range projection or the hereditary subalgebra is generated by these two elements are the same. Oh yeah, I should also say, while I'm talking about this, two other examples. If we have functions f and g, if we have a commutative theta algebra, then f is less than or equal to g, if and only if the set of x's where f of x is non-zero is contained in the set of x's where g of x is non-zero. So that may also illustrate what this particular comparison does. Another example would say, can I write in this? I hope it goes. If you have A and B in a matrix algebra, positive elements in a matrix algebra, then it holds that A less than or equal to B, if and only if the dimension of the range of A is less than the dimension of the range of B. So this is the range of A and this is the range of B. So that is another way of illustrating what this particular comparison does. And so let us now make the definition. If A is a theta algebra, then we say that A is purely infinite. If two things hold, A has no abelian quotient, and this particular condition resembles the assumption we made in the simple case that A cannot be the complex numbers, and for all elements A and B positive elements, if A belongs to the first two-sided ideal generated by B, so this is closed two-sided ideal generated by B, then A is less than or equal to B in the sense of Kunz. The other indication, by the way, always holds to be good for both ways. So we can right away decide that, for example, MN of A, MN is not truly infinite. But then we call M2, maybe even easier. Well, M2 actually, the first condition is okay, it has no abelian function, it is simple and not abelian. But if we look at this element, let me put it like this. This element and this element here, then this one is not less than equal to this one in the sense of Kunz, because this has rank 2 and this has rank 1. And 2 is not less than 1. So we just use our example here. But it is true that this element here belongs to the closed two-sided ideal generated by this element here, because the latter is equal to M2. Right. One other thing we shall see later is that let me call it a proposition. If A has a trace, then A is not purely infinite. I think I've made the mistake. Oh, yeah. I will now try to relate being purely infinite to the Kunz semigroup that Andrew has talked about. And I'll make various cases by this is the right definition and prove various results, and this somehow is what I will spend the rest of my time doing, both today and next time, arguing why this is really a good definition. And maybe the first argument towards this is relating this to the Kunz semigroup. I will use here the original definition of the Kunz semigroup. It can also somehow be completed that Elliot and his co-workers have done with much success in order to get some good continuity properties for it. But I will just stick now with the old-fashioned version. For one thing, we can, given a C-star by A, then you can define an infinity of A as being simply just the union of all matrix antibodies over A, and you can view them as sitting inside each other by putting, say, the 3x3 matrices into the upper left corner of the 4x4 matrices. And we define an equivalence relation of this one here by saying that, supposing that A and B are matrix antibodies over A, then we say that A is equivalent to B if A less than equal to B and B less than equal to A in the sense of Kunz. And this is relatively to this algebra here. And this defines the equivalence relation, and then simply the Kunz semigroup is now, by definition, just all positive elements in infinity of A modulo this equivalence relation. And hence it consists of equivalence classes that are noted by A with brackets around them, where A is a positive element in some matrix algebra over A. And this set is equipped with two operations, a plus and a and an order relation. We add two elements by simply looking at the class. This also is noted by A direct sum B. So we have two matrices then you can just make a larger matrix where A sits as the upper left corner and B sits as the lower right corner. And so this corresponds basically to adding them orthogonally to each other. And this will define an operation plus on this one here. And if we have two elements in the continuum group, then we say one is less than the other, if and only if A less than or equal to B. This really only makes sense if they both belong to the same matrix algebra. You can also make sense of it if they belong to different matrix algebras, but you can assume that they belong to the same matrix algebra simply by choosing the largest one. So this way we get, as a result, an ordered abelian semigroup. And let me now make a small remark that you can always, for any sigma algebra A, define a mapping from the semigroup into the ideal lattice of A. And by the way, so the ideal lattice of A, that is just a set of all closed two-sided ideals. And this is, of course, an ordered set. If you have two ideals, one can be contained in another. But it is actually also a semigroup. If you have two ideals, you can take the sum of them. So this is also an ordered abelian semigroup. So this one, an ordered abelian semigroup. And what this map should do is it should take, if you have a positive element, well, okay, let's say you have a positive element in A, then the class of that one is simply mapped into the closed two-sided ideal that it generates. And if, for example, you instead had a positive element, so the 2x2 matrix over A, well, then you map the class of that one into some ideal J, obtained by saying M2 of A, little a, M2 of A. Now this is a closed two-sided ideal in 2x2 matrix over A. And any such is of the form M2 of J, where J is some ideal in A. And then of course it, you can divide it similarly for if A belongs to any other matrix algebra. So you have this mapping here, and let me then, am I doing this right? And about this mapping, you can say that it is always, so this map is always the following onto and additive and monotone. So it prefers addition in both single groups and the order structure, and it's onto. That's always the case. And then we have the following, let us call it a proposition. This map is 1-1, hence an isomorphism. If and only if A is purely infinite. So this is one first remark about purely infinite algebras, that somehow singleton ought to make them look nice. And let me just argue briefly why this is the case. Supposing that we have two elements, positive elements in A itself, And then if such that they are being mapped to the same element, that means that we have two possible elements that go to the same thing over here. Such that these ideals are the same, then obviously A belongs to this thing here because it belongs here, and B belongs to this thing here because it belongs here, and hence by being purely infinite, assuming that A is purely infinite, we get that A less than or equal to B, and that B less than or equal to A, and by definition, this is the same as saying that A is equivalent to B, which is the same thing as saying that the classes are the same. So I didn't prove the other indication, this goes along the same line, and one thing which is more crucial, supposing that A and B are not in A, but in some matrix such far away, then it is more complicated. Supposing that A belongs here, then we need to know that MN of A is purely infinite. And I will come back to that later. This is not completely trivial to prove. Okay. And let me, just before the break, make another description of being purely infinite. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, good point. Right. Let's see, that's an interesting... yeah, you're absolutely right. I would assume that, and in the... Yeah. Right. Good point, yeah. Precisely. So then they even think you generated. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's separable then. This is right there. Then the ideal is also separable. So it's good to say that I'm soon assume the separability. Separability. See here. And maybe I even think it's generated. Okay, and let me just very briefly talk about, and then I'll continue after the break, infinite and properly infinite elements. And you can see that being purely infinite is defined in terms of comparison of positive elements, where infiniteness, since the nominal enterprise, is determined in terms of properties of projections. So basically what we do here, when we work with fixed enterprise, we say, well, we don't need, we may not have as many projections around, but we have lots of positive elements around, so we have somehow to make use of those. This very explicitly goes into the definitions that we have seen here. And hence, properties such as being finite, infinite, properly infinite for projections, it would be very nice to have similar notions for positive elements. And sort of works out well, I mean, with some difficulties that I will briefly mention to you. So suppose that A is a positive element in A, when we say that A is infinite, if there exists a non-zero element B, such that A directs from B less than or equal to A. And we say that A is trouble internet. If A directs from A, they send equal to A. And one may want to add that A is non-zero. I don't. Sometimes it's convenient to say that zero is probably infinite, and sometimes not. The only bad thing about allowing zero to be probably infinite is that then that would be probably infinite, not infinite. Well, zero cannot be infinite. There's one fact saying that this extends the notions for predictions. And the only non-trivial thing is to check that about the infinite case. In the probably infinite case, it is more or less clear to see. So, so this means the following, that if P in A is a projection, and if B in A class is non-zero positive elements, such that P directs on B less than or equal to P in the sense of Kunz, then there exists Q in A, a projection, such that P directs on Q less than or equal to P in the usual sense of Murray phenomenon. Let me underline that. Murray phenomenon equivalent to projection Q naught, per P naught less than P. I will not prove that statement, but there's something that is true. It's not very hard to show, but it's not completely obvious at first sight. So we have these notions, so they extend well, and let me just before the break mention one proposition related to these two to each other, and this both holds for positive elements and holds also for projections. If I have A in A plus, then A is properly infinite if and only if for every ideal in A one has that A plus I is either zero or A plus I is infinite. And this takes place, of course, in the closed A mod I. In other words, an element which is infinite but not properly infinite will have the property that in some closure it is finite and non-zero. So this is how what distinguishes these two properties from each other. And so I'll take a break now, and I'll give you a break myself, and then I will go on and talk a little bit about properties of the elements and how they relate to being purely infinite. I don't know how long breaks do we usually have. Is it 10 minutes? Is that good? That's more or less, but... Oh, that's interesting.
Wait, right there.
This one?
Yeah.
Here. Oh! Was it here? Wonderful. Alright, I take. So let me just continue a little bit along the lines of talking about the properly entered element, and so they're defined by this relation here, and I guess it is useful also to rephrase it. By saying that an element is properly infinite if and only if in the continuity group 2 times the class of A is less than or equal to the class of A, but the other inequality also holds, so we have actually equality. And it is the same thing as saying that for every pair of natural numbers one has that K times the class of A is the same as L times the class of A. So this way one can somehow also define the notion of being properly infinite for ordered abelian groups. And I will now go into another property of properly infinite elements, and for this I need to introduce the notion of what is called the epsilon cutdown that probably all of you have seen. If you have a positive element and you have a positive number epsilon, then you can associate the positive element denoted this way. And this is simply given by another way of defining it is to say that it is F epsilon of A, where F epsilon is a specific continuous function that does the following. And this is 45 degrees. And another way of saying it is that this is really just take A, if A had a unit, then you would take A minus epsilon times this unit, and then you take the positive part of that self-drawn element. Actually, epsilon cut down. There's one fact, there are several facts. If A and B are positive elements, then it holds that A is less than or equal to B if and only if for every positive epsilon one has that epsilon A minus epsilon less than or equal to B. And again under the same assumption, if A minus B is less than epsilon, then it holds that A minus epsilon less than or equal to B. Now one particular property I'm after uses when another fact, maybe we again say we have two positive elements, then it says that B belongs to, B belongs to the closed two-sided ideal generated by A. This holds if and only if for all epsilon greater than zero there exists a natural number K such that the epsilon cut down of B, its class in the continuity group is less than K times the class of A. Maybe a slightly complicated statement, but this is a precise description of the positive elements which belongs to the ideal generated by another positive element phrased in terms of the continuity group.
Yeah. Less
than or equal, or less than this is
curly. Yeah.
And this is curly and curly. Yeah. And this is just in the symbol. Right. So we have this one here, and This gives rise to the following proposition. And again, A and B are positive elements, and supposing that A is properly infinite, then if B belongs to the closed two-sided field generated by A, that entails that B is less than or equal to A. So under the additional property that A is properly infinite, then this somewhat complicated statement can be replaced by this much easier one. And let me just argue why this is the case. Let epsilon be greater than 0. If B belongs to the closed two-sided ideal generated by A, then there exists a number k such that the epsilon cut down of B is less than k times class of A. But now if A is properly infinite, then we could use this remark over here to say that k times A is the same thing as any other multiple of A, k. And the multiple we can choose to be 1. So this is the same as there's a class of A. And that is then saying that B minus epsilon is less than or equal to A. And since this holds for any positive epsilon, we conclude that B is less than or equal to A, using this remark up here. And let me just take another proposition. Take a positive element A. So this proposition somehow tries to relate being properly infinite to being properly infinite in the usual sense for projections. Then we can look at the vertices of subalgebra generated by A. And we can take the multiplier algebra, this one here. And supposing this is properly infinite, so by M I mean the multiplier algebra, so I take the multiplier algebra generated by this vertical subalgebra, if that is properly infinite, then we can conclude that A is properly infinite. And actually an interesting question, I don't know if the machinery that Jort has developed, Jort and his co-authors, will be able to decide that is, does this hold? I mean, supposing that A is probably, can we then conclude that this one here is probably infinite?
Wait, what does 3M, what's this?
This is multiplier algebra. One consequence is that suppose you take, this is an example, suppose you take A in the compact, so by K it just means the compact operators, which is strictly positive, then by definition that means that the red-haired subalgebra generated by that one is just all the compacts. And hence B of 8, which is the multiplier algebra of the compact, is then the multiplier algebra of this one here. So we conclude that there is, and this is properly infinite, so we conclude that it is properly infinite. Yeah.
And possibly
infinite would
mean it was some equivalent to some stable
ideal. In which case, the multiplier algebra would be properly. Yeah. Of course, state rank 1 goes a little bit against, not completely, but a little bit against not entirely, actually. I mean, there are state rank 1 algebras which are purely infinite even. So in other words, in the compact operators, we can have properly infinite elements, which is maybe at first sight a little bit counterintuitive, because one would view as the compact as being something very finite. But I think it is important to make note of that. And for sure, these people who have been working on the Kunsemi group, from the point of view of George Eliot, have encountered this kind of phenomenon.
Part of the definition that we say is in the idea of trying to create an A in whose the law be, and you're proving that as a proposition when it's wrong. So just continue by that.
I'll prove up.
Part of the definition we
put. Yeah, but I mean, no, there are two different things. That an element is properly infinite and a C classifier is purely infinite. I don't know. Actually, both are abbreviated PI oftentimes, which is extra unfortunate. Yes. Yes, that's a good question. By this I mean that the unit for this algebra is a properly infinite prediction. So this was some remarks about probably infinite elements. One question that I will try later on to relate that to other things, but that bothered us a lot in the beginning was the following that we still don't have the answer for. Suppose you have two positive elements, both of which are properly infinite. Does it follow that their sum is probably infinite? And actually, at this point, I must confess, I mean, it's a long time ago, I wrote that paper. I just had the feeling that if you could prove that, there was something we could prove also. I simply forgot what it was. I mean, there was really a good reason why we asked ourselves this question, but I will try to find out. I mean, if you have this thing, I mean, what then can you do? It's not just because we asked it because it seemed like a natural enough question, but we really need it for something. And I'll recall which one it was, but I mean, so this is. No.
Okay, but look,
do you?
Well, sure, it seems to me that if you say that A properly infinite is the same as saying it's equivalent to something which generates a closed two-sided ideal, then after all, equivalence to that is equivalent, isn't it? It's equivalent to that.
Yes.
Okay, but then. The
orthogonal sum of
two things.
I mean, if the orthogonal is okay, I mean, now these are not necessarily orthogonal. Then let me just say, it's okay if.
Well, that's not the orthogonal.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. I'm confused with
semi-group of things. Yeah, of course, yeah. But I mean, I see your mark with semi-group. Actually, I think also, I remember now what it was. I'll come back to the consequence of this one here. I think I will also summarize some open questions 2 weeks from now and also mention some consequences. But I mean, also somehow to say that in this theory, I mean, many things that go very well for projections, do result in some strange problems when you consider just positive elements, or the more general context of positive elements. Okay, now, let me continue to the next things where we gather some pieces together. There are three results that are whose proofs are quite kind of woven into each other. I will only very briefly address the proofs. One says that we have a C-type by A, then this is purely infinite. If and only if all positive elements in A are properly infinite. So I would even say that maybe stay defining purely infinite, I mean maybe even this would make more sense defining it in this way. Saying that the C algebra is purely infinite even only if all positive elements are properly infinite, but fortunately it turns out to be the same. Another result says that if you have a short exact sequence, then A is purely infinite if and only if I and B are purely infinite. And it is in particular the thing that if the ideal and the quotient is purely infinite and the algebra is purely infinite, somehow the way to prove that goes through this theorem and somehow both ways in a curious way. And finally, one I'll call here a lemma, saying that if A is purely infinite, then so is any matrix algebra over A. And the last one will then result in a theorem saying that if A and B are strictly isomorphic, and A is purely infinite, then B is purely infinite. And of course, this result here says more than this one here. But once you have this one, it's quite easy to get this one. So let me just briefly address the proof of the theorem. This direction here if all possible elements are properly infinite, is basically contained in this result we had up here, because supposing that we have positive elements such that B belongs to the closed two-sided ideal by A, generated by A, and we know that A is properly infinite, then automatically by that proposition we get that B less than or equal to A. So actually we have already the one direction. And let me briefly go into the other direction, and that this somehow is more tricky, but maybe for an interesting reason. There's one fact which is really easy to prove. Supposing that N2 of A is purely infinite, then all A and A plus are properly infinite. There's this claim here. And let's see why that is true. It is true because we have that if I double A, then this belongs to the closed two-sided ideal generated by just a single copy of A. And hence, if this M2 of A is purely infinite, this would then entail that the double of A is less than or equal to A, one copy of A, and this somehow translates into the statement that this is equal to A direct sum A, and this is for all practical purposes A. Hence, A is properly infinite. And one can then what has a following, we can call it a theorem, I think that would be fair to say, that goes back to Glynn, saying the following. Suppose that A is a non-abelian C algebra. Then there exists a mapping from the cone over the 2x2 matrices over A into A, an embedding, or at least let me just say a mapping which is non-zero. In many cases you can also choose it to be an embedding, but obviously, for example, if A were the 2x2 matrices itself, then you can map this one into, but not injectively. So let us just say a non-zero mapping. So then there exists such a non-zero mapping here. I will not prove this statement, but this is a nice and very useful result. And
Jeff, this question
property was in place, multiplier or outputs property. Seems to me that what that amounts to is proving that two elements are equivalent, if one of them is properly, then the other one is.
But that is clearly true.
Yes, but that's all you have from, I guess if you, there only is an element which is, if no one is properly, this means that the chimney is equivalent to the generator of some staple of,
it is. I mean, if that was the case, then...
And then the multiplier output of that is on...
Yeah. And that... No, I don't think that's true, because, I mean, there could be a projection for that matter. I mean, it probably isn't a projection. I mean, that would not have that property, would it?
Oh.
Anyway, I think it's, it could be worthwhile thinking about, and anyways, we have this thing here, and then if you use this idea, so from this simple argument, you can obtain the following fact, that given a mapping psi from the cone over the 2x2 matrices into A, which is still assumed to be purely infinite, then all positive elements A in, and then you take the ideal generated by the image of psi are probably infinite. So basically, just using this argument here and then elaborating a little bit on it, then you get something like this. So in combination with Klimt's theorem, you at least get that some ideal, a non-zero ideal, of a purely infinite series of entirely consists of probably infinite elements. And then somehow by combining the proof of this one and this one, you get everything and after some additional work. But one reason also for mentioning this at this point could be that Klimt's theorem, I mean, it's really a beautiful and nice theorem, it's not so hard to prove, but the big problem with it is that we don't know how big the image is. And supposing, for example, you have a C algebra that has no abelian quotient, then one might ask, can you then find such an embedding so that the image is full? Actually, this, you can show this is not true. So that you cannot do. But maybe if you then ask more, supposing that A has no finite dimension quotient, I mean, say you give a little bit more space, this is then true. Can you then find a mapping from here into A so the image is full? And that is open. So even though it's a very, very simple statement, then somehow obvious generalizations of this one here are still not known, and I suspect they could be false. And this is somehow what makes this proof kind of complicated. Okay, so let's see what I have next on mind. Right, so the next thing I would like to show is that, so now I've given some descriptions being purely infinite, and we have some permanence results, and there are two things I would now like to relate to properties of purely infinite. Let me just consider some properties. Suppose A is a C-star algebra. Then we can look at the property that A is isomorphic to A tensor or infinity. We can look at the property that A is purely infinite. And we can look at the property that A has no traces. And what I will show now is that we have implications going like this. I can, of course, not prove the opposite implication, they are false, but we can say a good deal about the opposite implications. And I will also elaborate a little bit on exactly what I mean by having no traces. And the first thing I will talk about is this implication here. And the other implication is somehow way more deep and important, and we have some good results along that line also. So to prove that first statement, it is not very hard to show. We need a theorem saying the following. Suppose that A is a separable field algebra. Then A is isomorphic to A tensor over infinity if and only if there exists a sequence phi n of unital star homomorphisms that are asymptotically central, meaning the following. So the image of phi n becomes more and more central as n tends to infinity. It commutes better and better with everything in A. And this is a multiplier by A. And if A is unital, then you can just forget about that. Then it's just A itself. And note also that you can find a unital star motion from infinity into a theta algebra, a unital theta algebra, if and only if that one is properly infinite, if the unit of that one is properly infinite. Okay, so now we can prove that this one here is purely infinite. So we take phi n that goes from O infinity into the multiplier as far of A tensor O infinity, noting that A tensor O infinity has that property here as above. And I take an arbitrary element A in A tensor O infinity, which is positive. And I want to show that if I double A, then it is less than or equal to just a single copy of A. Hence that given positive element is probably, so I want to show this thing here. And to do that, I use O infinity and I take two isometries. Let me just call S and T. And such that the range projections are orthogonal. And then I do the following. I look at this 2x2 matrix, A 0 0 0. So this is an element, and this is the adjoint of that element. And as n tends to infinity, this goes to this thing here. And why is that true? Well, if you look at, let's look at this corner here, for example. Then this corner will be phi n t star a phi n of s. And as n tends to infinity, we can almost move this one over here, and then just use that these are orthogonal. And if I were to look at this one here, it would instead be phi n t star a phi n t. And again, as n tends to infinity, we can almost move this one over here, and then it becomes equal to 1. So, this proves the statement with one small modification, namely that if you really look at the definition of comparison, then I've cheated a little bit because these elements here, they belong to the 2 by 2 matrix over the multipliers of A, and they really should belong to the algebra, which is the multiply algebra. Well, okay, if it was universal, then everything is fine, and you could also rescue it simply by taking and dividing A, say, A to the 1 over 3, A to the 1 over 3, and A to the 1 over 3, and then using this part over here and this part over there, and then getting things back into the algebra itself. But let me not elaborate more on that one. So in particular, we get that I mean, we now write down a whole list of things that are purely infinite. So one example would be, say, C0 of R tends to infinity is purely infinite. But also projectionless. So in other words, this emphasizes that being purely infinite should not be phrased in such a way that it assumes the existence of projections. The next thing I will talk about, and that will be the last thing for this time, I may not even quite finish it, is how traces and pure infinites disagree with each other, so to say. And at first I will talk about states on the Kunsemi group. Of the Kunsemi group at W of A is, or for that matter, of any ordered abelian group, is a map F that goes from W of A into, and then let me allow it to go from 0 to and including infinity. This is for this particular purpose kind of practical. Such that F is additive and monotone. So just an additive auto-preserving map from here to here. That's the state. And we say that F is non-degenerate if its image is not entirely enclosed in the two extreme values, 0 and infinity. Let's see. It's probably F0 to be 0 would probably be nice, yeah. Why don't we say that? Yeah, we'll probably like that. Yeah, I mean, Chris has an interesting point, yeah. So that's a good. It is non-degenerate if it is not containing. Thank you very much. Okay, and that is true, and they certainly are very interesting and important. By this point, I don't mention them. But continuity properties are really crucial also.
Homogeneity, continuity, you wouldn't have real continuity.
Yeah, but that somehow, in my sense, doesn't quite make sense. I don't think I can multiply a number by a real number. I don't think even I can multiply by a Bessner number for that matter. Mm. So we have then, let us just call it a proposition. If A is purely infinite, then W of A admits no non-degenerate state, degenerate state. And the proof is simply assume F is a non-degenerate state. And take X as we then can, such that zero less than f of X less than infinity. Then, as 2X is the same as X, that's somehow the defining property in the continuity group of purely infinite C-types, by that we always have this condition, we get that 2 times f of X is equal to f of X. And that is a contradiction. So that was an easy thing. Now, the next thing where George's question is particularly relevant is that there is a way of taking a state on the continuity group and lifting it to a cross-equation C-algebra, and you can go back again. But if you go one way and back again, then you don't get back where you started. But you get back to that. Only if what it began with was continuous, you would get back to where you started. So let me describe how that goes. Yeah, I think that's what, yeah, that could be right, yeah.
So the inclusion that you've got there is basically that it's two modifier projections are very phenomenal equivalent and the hereditary subalgebras are completely equivalent, so it's the positive, it's a strictly positive element of the equivalent. But the, and the converse, actually I don't think I know the Calvary Delta equivalent.
Yeah, that certainly sounds right, yeah. Maybe we should think about that problem. Okay, so where was I? Yeah, so there's a process now. We can take F, a state on W of A, and so that thing construct something called power of F, which happens to be a quasi-trace. And I will, on A, and let me say A plus. And I will elaborate a little bit about what is a quasi-trace. But let me just write down the formula and then we talk about what it is. And it's given by, if A is a positive element, then this new thing here is simply take the interval from zero to the norm of A, or you could go all the way up to infinity, but might not stop here, and then take the T epsilon cut down, or let us call it T cut down, its class in the continuity group, and then apply F to that one, and then integrate that. If T is greater than the norm of A, then this is zero, so that's why it stops here. And so this clearly is a delta positive number. So this one is a lower semi-continuous two quartet rate on A. And by that I mean, well, a quartet trace is everything, you take the definition of a trace, that's a quartet trace, except one thing is not additive necessarily. So, tau of, this condition here doesn't necessarily hold. It's only known to hold when A and B commute. So we only assume additivity for commuting positive elements. And then there were more things. It was lower semi-continuous. This is if A n increases up to A, that should imply that tau F of A n converges to tau F of A. That is lower semi-continuous, and it's a two quartet trace, means that it extends to a quartet trace on the 2x2 matrices over A, but not necessarily canonically. Not necessarily by just adding the diagonal together. And it is a theorem of Uwe Horrup and also Kirchberg in the non-universal case, that any lower semi-continuous two quartet trace on an exact sheaf algebra is a trace, an honest trace. Well, okay, the only small difference here from a really honest trace, I mean, this is only a semi-honest trace, the only difference is that I allow traces to take the value plus infinity. So, for example, I would be happy to say that B of H has a trace. And it's only defined on positive elements, somehow, otherwise it doesn't really make sense. You can't take the trace of a general self-dual element in B of H, but you can certainly take the trace of a positive element in B of H, and it may have the value plus infinity. Okay, so that is how to go from state on the continuum group to a quartet trace in the other direction. If tau is a lower semi-continuous two quartet trace or a trace, even better, then we can make a state on the continuum group, so let me put it like this, and it is given by, take the limit as epsilon goes to zero from the right of the trace of A, let's call it phi epsilon of A, where phi epsilon is the following function. This one here. It is 0 at 0 and goes very quickly up to 1 and stays 1. And you will recognize that this is basically the same thing as going from a measure to an integral and back again. So the state on W of A corresponds to the measure and the cross trace corresponds to the integral. Now, given this, it is now clear that we have the following. proposition, if A is purely infinite, then A admits no non-degenerate slower semi-continuous two horse race. No, I said that it didn't emit a state on the continuous group.
Well, okay.
But I just showed that the two were the same. So therefore I, well, I said it already, I said it over here, but I didn't prove it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm ready to prove it. I mean, we did prove it already. And the proof is simply that if it did have a non-degenerate with lower semi-continuous two-process phrase, then we can use this formula to make a state on the Kunsemi group that then also would be non-degenerate, but that is inconsistent with that observation we had up there. I sort of had a small remark. Well, it's time, so this is a good place to stop.